First, I'm going to invite you to use your smartphones during this sermon. And that might be an unusual request, but I'll need you to have access to a particular painting I have been thinking about as I've thought about this sermon. It's listed in the bulletin there. Go to your web browser to Google or, Stephen, Juju, and type in conversion on the way to Damascus, comma, Caravaggio. And take a little time to do that and share that image with those nearby who might not have it or access to it. If you look under images, it should be one of the first ones that comes up. I'm looking for you to have in your hands a visual interpretation by the Renaissance artist Caravaggio of this moment in Acts 9 of Saul's conversion. It's going to be the one that shows at the bottom of the painting a person lying on the ground with their arms out and hands outstretched under a horse who calmly stands above them. So, have you guys found that?
Good thing I was an art major.
Yeah. Yes, that's the one, Brett. That's the one. It's a beautiful painting. It's the one I always think of when I think of Acts 9. But hold that one. Use that as kind of a visual reference to this part here. Now, I'm giving you permission to utilize your smartphones, but don't ignore my sermon. But then I can't really curb your choices. You can go where you wish. Anyway, keep it handy. It's helpful to see that visual. I was constantly thinking about it as I was thinking about this sermon. What I want to do is address two sections in this chapter of Acts. The first I want to tackle is the last two vignettes featuring the Apostle Peter and some wonderful things God did through him. And then second, I want to take on the larger section here of Saul's conversion, the significance of which we probably all need to be reminded of in the life and history of our church heritage. It's a significant moment. It's a significant moment. It's an astonishing moment of the New Testament. But first, I want to look at the end of Acts 9, verses 32 through 43. And here we have two very powerful, miraculous moments that God does through his servant, the Apostle Peter. And just, thinking about Peter, the way he was in the gospel, and here he's doing this, the way he was even in the early part of this, it's just amazing, the turnaround. Peter being dumb and acting and speaking before he thinks, and then he's doing this stuff. And then these two incidences, one is building upon the other in power, it seems. In verses 32 through 35, we have the restoring of Aeneas to mobilization. Here in Lydda, there was a man, Aeneas, who had been paralyzed for 8 years. Now, we don't know any of the backstory as to why Aeneas was paralyzed. We don't know much about the community, except that there were believers, and it seems like it might have emerged, this community of believers might have, these saints, might have grown out of the persecution that arose in the previous chapter, it seems. Which says, and Saul, at the beginning of the chapter, it says, and Saul approved of his execution, being Stephen. Saul approved of Stephen's execution. And there arose that day a great persecution against the church in Jerusalem, and there they were all scattered throughout the regions of Judea and Samaria, except the apostles. Do you see the reference there, Judea and Samaria? Do you see? Remember the reference? Acts 1? Jerusalem, Judea, Samaria. Okay, you're getting the pattern here? So some theologians think it's possible that as many as 12 years might have passed between the very first chapter and this moment of that persecution. So they were in Jerusalem for 12 years, and God finally goes, all right, kick him out with the persecution. So, because if you see what happens, and I'm sure Terry did, I hear he did a great job in talking about the previous chapter and how the word spread. Well, it's spreading. It's continuing to spread. And in this case, to Judea and Samaria. So back to Ananias. And we don't know if Ananias was even among the saints. We just are told that the saints brought him. And it's possible, I think it's implied that he was a part of the church there in Lydda. But regardless, Peter goes to Aeneas and says, Jesus Christ heals you. He doesn't say, I heal you. He doesn't say, God heals you. He says, Jesus Christ heals you. And that's very significant, especially in this moment of history. And as a result, Aeneas gets up after being unable to walk for 8 years, and he walks. And that must have been quite a thrilling moment for him. Just amazing. Then in verses 36 through 43, we have a more significant miracle happen. It isn't the restoring of someone's body to wholeness, as in Aeneas' paralyzing characteristics. This is a wholesale restoration to life of Tabitha, also called Dorcas, which means gazelle, by the way. And I know this because my grandmother's name is Dorcas. Very, very sweet woman. It's kind of a little vignette in the Acts that I really enjoy because my grandmother's name was Dorcas. Now, in these verses, we have a little more information about the victim. In the previous one, we just have this guy's name, and they had a church there, the saints. But in this one, we got more information than we do about Aeneas. It's no less powerful that we don't know as much about Aeneas, but it's just a really interesting thing. But in these verses, we see the significance of who Dorcas was to this community. It says she was full of good works and acts of grace. It's pretty cool. And it says more, that Dorcas's life had such an impact on the followers of Jesus in Joppa, near Lydda, which is where Peter was, that they sent two men decided to go to ask Peter to come and heal Tabitha. It might even been that she was dead already. It's not completely clear. Sometimes they say, and she died, and then they explain the story. Sometimes the way they structure certain stories in the scriptures, but it's unclear. Regardless, she was dead by the time Peter arrived. So Peter leaves with the messengers, and in that time, either Dorcas was dead or she dies. And by the time Peter and the messengers go, they're well into mourning for her. She's in an upper room somewhere, and they're mourners, and they're already in action. So Peter puts everyone out of the room where Dorcas's body is, and it says he knelt and prayed. And then it says, after praying, this is an interesting phrase, and turning to the body, he said, "Tabitha, arise." It's interesting that it says turning to the body. You would think he would have been praying over the body. I think one of the Old Testament prophets, maybe Elisha, at one point was praying over the body of over the son of a widow. But it's almost like Peter goes into the room, just sees the body, kneels in the middle of the room, prays to God, then turns the body and talks to Tabitha and Dorcas. And Dorcas is restored to life. Now, it's interesting that he doesn't use Jesus' name here. Of course, there was no one else around. But that's just an interesting observation. But I think it's important at this point to revisit the purpose of miracles here. I talked a little bit about this before, but what are miracles and what is their purpose? Now, it would seem that miracles are apparent events that override natural order. They are apparent events that override natural order. I don't think that they contradict natural order, but I do think they supplant natural order. I think a miracle is a replacing of our current state of existence to a greater or more real order. A miracle cannot be explained humanly, rationally. And I say it that way on purpose. It cannot be explained humanly, rationally. Humanly, I cannot rationalize the restoring of Aeneas to walking. I can't rationalize that. Nor can I rationalize Dorcas being dead and now she's alive. If we were to take a look at these moments scientifically, I think we would, I mean, if we were able to take a lab and do scans and put all our 20th century, 21st century technology at the moment that Peter says Jesus Christ heals you to Aeneas, we like analyze that scientifically, I think we might get some information. We'd get some things that might make sense from those scans. But I would wager there would be a lot of things that we would see that would not make sense because we wouldn't have the ability to understand them. And that's only the stuff that we would be able to see. I mean, that's not considering the things that are outside our ability to perceive. They do exist. Things outside of our ability to perceive do exist. But that doesn't make miracles any less true. I'm reminded of the part in the performance of All the Dogs and Horses that we had here by XOXO. It was performed here at Art Party last year. There was a place in the story where the heroine and her companion, a talking horse, if you weren't here, it's a really great show and you should watch it. But so there's a point in the story where the heroine and the companion and her talking horse are running. I think it was a severe moment. They're running, I think, from a storm or the evil character. I don't remember exactly what they were running from. But in that process of running, the horse breaks its leg. Now, and Poco is aware of this, a horse with a broken leg is essentially a death sentence. It's a dramatic moment. The heroine is forced to kill her companion just out of compassion so that the horse wouldn't suffer and put him out of his misery. And right after, so she takes the gun, and right after the moment where the heroine pulls the trigger, shooting the horse in the head, the talking horse resurrects completely whole. The legs healed, he's whole. Then for the next few minutes, there is an interchange of dialogue that goes something like, I don't remember it exactly, but I remember the tone. It goes something like, but you were dead, I shot you. I know, I shot you and now you're alive. I know, I was there. And it ends with something like, well, okay, you're alive now. I'm alive now, okay, and the story continues. So it's kind of like they experience this dramatic, miraculous moment. They don't know how to explain it other than, well, you're alive now. Yes, you were dead, yes. Okay, yay! And they go, I mean, that's kind of what miracles are. It's like, Aeneas is healed. You were paralyzed. I know. For 8 years, I know, I was there, I was paralyzed, right? Now you're not. I know, isn't that great? Yes, it's great. I mean, that's kind of what a miracle is. It's kind of like, wow, Dorcas, you were dead. I know. But now you're alive. I was there, I know. I mean, I woke up and there's Peter standing over me with his hand. Once, I mean, it's, how do you explain that? So, that's the nature of a miracle. I said earlier how a miracle seems to defy human reason and rationality, and that there's something to that, but I don't think that's completely true. I don't think it completely overrides human reason and rationality. Think about it. If the God of the universe is like the one we talked about in the Hebrew and Christian scriptures, the Old and New Testament, if the God of the universe is like that, and he did create everything we see, then it isn't a far stretch to think that he can restore the molecules of someone's body so that they can walk again. It's not a stretch. I'm using my human reason to reason. If this God exists this way, and he's the one that spoke and put everything into existence, everything we're walking on, then for him to be able to restore the molecules of someone's body, like Aeneas, is not a far stretch. It's not a far stretch to think that he can make it so that he can walk on water. If he created the water and he created the body that Jesus in, it was Jesus's body, it is not a far stretch to think that Jesus can walk on water. And it isn't a stretch to think that he can't reinvigorate the dead body to life again. But that's what he does in this miracle. I mean, who knows why Aeneas was paralyzed? Could have been a muscle thing, could have been a brain neurological damage through some sort of accident, or more than likely was a broken spine of some sort, but God can restore that. He made that spine. Why can't he restore it? So what is the purpose? That's what a miracle is. What is the purpose? I don't think that miracles are unreasonable. I think they're super reasonable. And it makes sense that God, who created all things, can do things that seem to contradict nature. Seem to. Miracles are multi-layered, and essentially, they're to be evidence of authority. I mean, there's all kinds of things that a miracle's purpose. It's, of course, to restore Aeneas to walking. It is to restore Dorcas to life. It is to show a future kingdom when those things will not exist. That's the purpose of a miracle. But I think the biggest thing, and in this case, it's evidence of authority. In the Gospel of Matthew chapter 11, there is a passage where some of John the Baptist's followers are sent to him to ask Jesus a question. And it goes like this. Now when John heard in prison about the deeds of Christ, he sent word by his disciples and said to him, "Are you the one to come, or shall we look for another?" And Jesus answered them, "Go and tell John what you hear and see. The blind receive sight and the lame walk. Lepers are cleansed and the deaf hear, and the dead are raised up, and the poor have the good news preached to them. And blessed is the one who's not offended by me." Jesus doesn't tell him, "Yes, I'm the one." He just says, "Well, tell him what you see. This blind guy received the sight. This lame woman who was lame is now walking. This leper here, Man, he was pretty in bad shape. He now is cleansed. This person was deaf, and now they hear. And this guy behind me, he was dead. Now he's raised. Go tell John this. So is that a yes? Yes. It's a different kind of yes. You see here that Jesus is pointing to the miraculous as evidence that he is the Messiah. Not that he needed it. So miracles are multi-layered and point to authority, but they also confound, and they're meant to confound. This is why the resurrection of Jesus is so stirring, both good and bad. It's hard to believe. The resurrection of Jesus, that's hard to believe. But it's hard to believe. Do you see the tone? That's hard to believe. It's hard to believe. I mean, they're meant to be confounding. Miracles will either convince you or they will repel you. You will either believe them or you don't. You were dead. I know. I was there. Let's go forward as if you're still alive. Okay. In Matthew 11, later on in that same chapter, Jesus says this very thing when he's talking about you can choose to believe or not to believe, even if you see it. He said in Matthew 11, then Jesus began to denounce the cities where most of his mighty works had been done because they did not repent. Woe to you, Chorazin. Woe to you, Bethsaida. For if the mighty works done in you had been done in Tyre and Sidon, they would have repented long ago in sackcloth and ashes. But I tell you, it is more bearable in the day of judgment for Tyre and Sidon than for you. And you, Capernaum, will you be exalted to heaven? You will be brought down to Hades. For if the mighty works done in you had been done in Sodom, Old Testament, it will remain until this day. But I tell you that it will be more tolerable in the day of judgment for the land of Sodom than for you. Jesus is acknowledging the fact that even if miracles are done, people can choose not to believe them. I can't explain that. That's a hard teaching. You can see a miracle with your very eyes and still choose not to believe it. Maybe not even seeing a miracle, but you can see common provisions of God and do the same. You can see common provisions of God and do the same and not believe them. I was reminded of this recently from C.S. Lewis's The Last Battle about this really interesting moment involving dwarfs that had been rescued by Aslan and brought into the real Narnia. But these dwarves still chose to live as if they were not living in the real Narnia. This became so distressing to Lucy, who was with Aslan at there, that she begged Aslan to make them see. And this is how it went. I'll read this for you. Aslan, said Lucy through tears, will you do something for these poor dwarfs? Dearest, said Aslan, I will show you both what I can and what I cannot do. He came close to the dwarfs and gave a low growl. Low, but it set all the air shaking. But the dwarfs said to one another, hear that? That's the gang at the other end of the stable trying to frighten us. They do it with a machine of some kind. Don't take any notice. They won't take us in again. Aslan raised his head and shook his mane. Instantly, a glorious feast appeared on the dwarf's knees. Pies, tongues and pigeons and trifles and ices, and each dwarf had a goblet of good wine in his right hand, but it wasn't much use. They began eating and drinking greedily enough, but it was clear that they couldn't taste it properly. They thought they were eating and drinking only the sort of things you might find in the stable. One said he was trying to eat hay, and another said he had got a bit of an old turnip. And a third said he had found a raw cabbage leaf. And they raised golden goblets of rich red wine to their lips and said, ugh, fancy drinking dirty water out of a trough that a donkey's been at. Never thought we'd come to this. But very, very soon, every dwarf began suspecting that every other dwarf had found something nicer than he had. And they started grabbing and snatching and went on to quarreling till in a few minutes there was a free fight. And all the good food was smeared on their faces and clothes or trodden underfoot. But when at last they sat down to nurse their black eyes and bleeding noses, they all said, well, at any rate, there's no humbug here. We haven't let anyone take us in. The dwarfs are for the dwarfs. You see, said Aslan, they will not let us help them. They have chosen cunning instead of belief. Their prison is only in their minds, yet they are in that prison and so afraid of being taken in that they cannot be taken out. But come, children, I have other work to do. He went to the door. They all followed him. Aslan raised his head and roared, "Now is time." Then louder, "Time." Then he said, and it was so loud it could have shaken the stars, "Time." And the door flew open. It's an interesting thing that I left that last part in there, because at some point God will walk away. He can only do so much. He wasn't going to rape those dwarves. He wasn't going to make them believe that they weren't in the old Aslan or old Narnia, but they were in the new. He was going to respect them. He tried. He listened to Lucy and tried to get them to see, but they refused to see. Similar to Jesus saying, "Woe to you, Chorazin. If the miracles had been done in Tyre and Sidon, they would have repented long ago." When Jesus was asked by his disciples why he told stories in Matthew 13, he said, they asked, "Why do you speak to them in parables?" And he answered, "To you has been given to know the secrets of the kingdom of heaven, but to them it has not been given. For to the one who has, the more will be given, and he will have an abundance. But for the one who has not, even what he has will be taken away. This is why I speak to them in parables, because seeing they do not see, and hearing they do not hear, and nor do they understand. Indeed, in their case, the prophecy of Isaiah is fulfilled that says, 'You will indeed hear, but never understand. You will indeed see, but never perceive.'" That's a hard teaching. That there's the will, the human will is a mysterious thing. It reminds me of the passage from Romans 1, my favorite passage, about experiencing miracles, experiencing communication that is from God, and sometimes people choose not to see what appears obvious. In Romans 1 and 18, it says, "For the wrath of God is revealed from heaven against all ungodliness and unrighteousness of men, who by their unrighteousness suppress the truth. For what can be known about God is plain to them, because God has shown it to them. For his invisible attributes, namely his eternal power and divine nature, have been clearly perceived ever since the creation of the world and the things that have been made, so they are without excuse." It's clear to everyone that God created this. It's clear. It's made plain. They suppress the truth. So let's not be timid about the fact that miracles are a large part of persuading people that Jesus is the Christ. Let's not be timid about that. I'm not going to back down from miracles. I can't completely explain them, but they are nonetheless true. Which brings me to the first section of this chapter, the conversion of Paul, or Saul in this case, in verses 1 through 19. This story is second in importance only to the gospel itself. Luke recounts this story two more times through Paul's speeches later on, and they'll be covered as we go through Acts. So it's three times in the book of Acts we see this story. Over the two millennia that the church has been in existence, whole sections, whole books have been written about this very moment in the history of Christianity, about Paul's conversion. Many skeptics have had to try to explain two main things about the origin of Christianity. One is the resurrection, of course. Life, death, and resurrection of Jesus. And the other is trying to explain Paul's conversion. Trying to explain and undermine the resurrection is understandable, but how does one who was once dead come to life again? I mean, that's understandable. We just talked about that being miraculous. For the Saul story, it is the degree of the dramatic turnaround that is the issue. How does one who is an avowed enemy of something do a complete change in a short period of time? How do you go from being one of Christianity's greatest killers to its greatest defender almost overnight? For the question of Saul's conversion, a big defense is why? If the biblical record is accurate, why would Saul, Paul, have changed sides? What possible benefit would he have gained from the switch? It makes no sense. First, he was Jewish. Okay, that's kind of in the history of the world, that's not a benefit mostly. I mean, the history of the Jews has not been a rather favorable for millennia. Paul did have the benefit of being a Roman citizen, so that helped, but that just meant that he grew up around more people unlike himself and probably experienced adversity as a Jew. So he was Jewish, sure, that was tough enough, but then maybe being an authority within the Jewish world helped, because he was a Pharisee. He was a Pharisee. He studied under a very respected teacher whom we heard from, remember Gamaliel. So there was that. So, okay, so he's with the Jews who aren't necessarily looked upon nicely through history. I'm a Jew, I can't fight that, but maybe I'll become authority in Jews. That will help my standing, Saul was probably thinking. So he gets authority so that it means that he could draw documents giving him permission to take out a small Jewish sect that had arisen around some guy from Nazareth. Okay. This is making really lots of sense. Paul is a Roman citizen, grows up in the Jewish community, comes to Jerusalem, studies under Gamaliel, gets lots of respect and authority. Obviously, he's a very persuasive arguer, which we see. He grows in authority, so much so that they come upon this sect that seems to be arising around this guy named Jesus from Nazareth. And these guys are doing some really interesting things. And they're being rebels. They keep coming into the temple to speak. So let's take these guys out. And when I mean take them out, Saul meant to kill them. So why would a guy who is on a pretty influential path to a powerful position in life suddenly decide, well, I'd like to join the Christians? I mean, talk about poor career choices. I'll join them. The ones you were trying to kill? Yes, I'm going to go join them. Why would, in a matter of days, he decided to join the very sect of people he was trying to wipe out on the very road he was on to Damascus to do that? Why? I mean, look at the rest of the section in chapter 9. I mean, look at the rest of the stories. What happens to Saul? So he gets converted. He starts preaching in Damascus, and what happens? He's so effective that everybody comes to Jesus. No. They set out to kill him, that he has to escape out of a basket. Then he goes to Jerusalem, where he tries to connect with the apostles, who avoid him, rightly so. Isn't this the guy that was trying to kill us? Yes. I don't know if I want to hang out with him. It took Barnabas to perceive that Saul was genuine and changed, that he introduces Saul to the apostles. And from there, Saul starts preaching in Jerusalem. So like in Damascus, he starts preaching and becomes very persuasive. He comes to Jerusalem and starts doing the same thing. And everybody in Jerusalem comes to Jesus. No. There, they also try to kill him. So they try and kill him in Damascus. They try and kill him in Jerusalem. So they send him off to Caesarea and then off to Tarsus. He's so effective in these two places that the opposition wants to kill him. Why? Why would you do that? Why? I mean, you were on the right side. Why would Saul just suddenly decide to join the very sect he was trying to wipe out? It reminds me of the argument kind of used to ask the question that the resurrection of Jesus did happen with the Lord, Liar, Lunatic argument. Have you heard that argument? It is a great summary by C.S. Lewis in Mere Christianity. It's this Paul-Saul thing is very similar to this, where Lewis says this about Jesus and his words and his actions. Okay, so Lewis writes, "I'm trying here to prevent anyone from saying the really foolish thing that people often say about Jesus. I'm ready to accept Jesus as a great moral teacher, but I don't accept his claim to be God. That is the one thing we must not say. A man who is merely a man and said the sorts of things Jesus said would not be a great moral teacher. He would either be a lunatic on the level with the man who says he's a poached egg, or he would be the devil of hell. You must make the choice. Either the man was and is the Son of God, or else a madman, or something worse. You can shut him up for a fool, you can spit on him and kill him as a demon, or you can fall at his feet and call him Lord and God, but let us not come up with any patronizing nonsense about his being a great human teacher. He has not left that open to us. He did not intend to. It's similar with Paul's conversion. If he was lying, why would he lie? If he was lying that he wasn't a Christian, why? What possible advantage would he have accomplished for his life? If he was crazy, okay, suppose he was nuts. He had some sort of nutty experience happen to him on the way to Damascus. It caused his mind to go psychotic or neurotic. If that's true, there was no indication that the church thought he was crazy. If he was crazy, show me where it is in his writings that he was nuts. I mean, he wrote 13 documents, which represents close to half of the New Testament. Why would we let a lunatic write half the New Testament? Why would we believe the lunatic? So if he wasn't lying and he wasn't crazy, what's the only conclusion? He was visited in a vision by Jesus of Nazareth, who told him to stop persecuting him and then told him what to do. And Saul, which is a kingly name in Israel, that's the first king of Israel, was Saul. So he goes from Saul, who adjusted his name to Paul later on, meaning small or little. So he goes from kingly name, I am Saul, to I'm Paul, I'm the least, I'm little, and followed Jesus for the rest of his life, even to martyrdom at the hands of Nero, where legend says he lost his life through a beheading because he was a Roman citizen. So now look at the painting by Caravaggio that I asked you to. We can get a little bit of an understanding of the power of that moment. Look at where most of the action is in that painting. It's at the bottom. The action is in Saul's body. How do we know that? Well, look at the horse. This is the moment where Jesus is appearing to Saul and causing Saul's soul to shudder. And there stands this horse, moving its one leg so as not to step on the idiot who fell off his back. It reminded me of, I was trying to find this quote. I don't know if it was Augustine or Luther said this. Someone asked, why do the birds fly away from me when I approach them? And I think it was Luther. He said, well, they know that they're in a better relationship with God than you are. So they fly off because they know you're an enemy of their creator. Well, the horse has no problem Jesus being there. I mean, that's Jesus. That's my creator. Saul's the one that's going, oh my gosh. So there stands the horse, not moving except one leg. And it's appropriate that Saul is at the bottom of the painting because God wanted to drive him there in order to raise him up. And of course, we know that he was raised up to suffer as our Lord did. And we are all blessed for it. I asked Cameron this, and I'll ask you guys. And if you guys don't get the answer right, I'll ask Cameron to give us the answer. If you look at that painting, take a look at the painting again. It's really interesting. Where's the light coming from? If you look at it, where is the light? Caravaggio had a light source in mind in that painting. Where did he place it? Can you tell? I'll give you the answer. Cameron, give him the answer.
It's coming from the middle of the painting.
You're coming from the middle of the painting. It's the light was right there. That's why Paul's almost like trying to push it away and hug it. You know, this is like the moment. Boom! Oh my gosh, who are you? Meanwhile, the horse is like, oh, that's Jesus. Don't you know him? So that's what's really cool about that painting. It really communicates the visceral moment for me. Jesus appears and boom, he's on the ground. Who are you? I am Jesus whom you're persecuting. So what can we learn here from this passage? First, take courage. I know that we don't live in the type of days that Saul did, not in our culture, but that could change rather quickly. And to know that there is a moment like this where Jesus could sway the heart of even the most ardent enemy is encouraging. While I was doing research for this sermon on this passage, I was coming across other similar stories of people who had been vehemently opposed Christianity, or the way, as it was called in this passage, and who, through a similar dramatic moment, changed completely and themselves became Christians. So it's encouraging. Take courage. 2, pray for your enemies. Pray for our enemies. I mean, look what can happen to them. It reminded me, a friend on Facebook had posted recently this status update. Don't pray imprecatory prayers for someone. You know what imprecatory, they're the ones that like bad things or that they die. I mean, there are some of those in the scriptures. It makes me uncomfortable. But his friend said, don't pray imprecatory prayers for someone. Pray that they convert. It's much more painful. I mean, look at Saul. Yeah, Saul's a great example. I'm not going to pray that you die. I'm going to pray that you come to know Jesus. Aha, look what happened to you. And we have 13 books from the scriptures. So pray for your enemies. Take courage and pray for your enemies. And then I wanted another thing here is I came across this quote about this passage from John Stott and his commentary, and I thought it was really good. And it was appropriate for our times. Stott wrote this: we should never be satisfied with a person's conversion. That is only the beginning. The same grace which brings a person to new birth is able to transform him or her into Christ's image. Every new convert becomes a changed person and has new titles to prove it, namely, a disciple or saint newly related to God, a brother or sister newly related to the church, and a witness newly related to the world. Conversion is not satisfying. The complete life is. Conversion helps. I thought I would close with Malcolm Guite's sonnet on the Apostle Paul, which is really powerful, which brings in all these things I've talked about Paul and Saul and how much we can appreciate. And it's called Apostle. An enemy whom God has made a friend, a righteous man discounting righteousness, last to believe and first for God to send. He found the fountain in the wilderness, thrown to the ground and raised at the same moment. A prisoner who set his captors free, a naked man with love his only garment, a blinded man who helped the world to see, a Jew who had been perfect in the law, blesses the flesh of every other race and helps them to see what the apostles saw. The glory of the Lord in Jesus' face, strong in his weakness, joyful in his pains, and bound by love, he freed us from our chains. Amen. Thank you, Jesus.